And our special guest this hour, Neil deGrasse Tyson. His latest work is called Welcome to the Universe. I'll tell you how you can get the book in just a moment. And we're going to come back and take your phone calls. I've got a few more questions as well. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Neil deGrasse Tyson with us, and we'll get to your calls in a second. The book, Welcome to the Universe. Neil, where did we get the book? Amazon for sure, right?
Yeah, Amazon works cleanly on that. It also should be in bookstores as well.
It's a great book.
They did a big push in bookstores, so yeah, thanks. We're all quite proud of it. It came out of a course that the three of us co-taught at Princeton University, and it became a really popular class, and we had to change rooms a couple of times just to accommodate.
I love
so
it.
We said, well, maybe there's something going on here that we should bring to a wider audience, and so that's what led to that book. So those the chapters in that book come out of entire lectures that each of us have given, and they're each identified with one of the three of us as you go through.
And I was going to ask you on the books, the lectures that you do, the television show Cosmos, do you find that people, Neil, are more interested now in science than they were a few years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think without a question, yes. And my evidence for that is manifold. And I'll give you just the top three. We can drill deeper if you'd like. One of them is consider that Cosmos in 13 parts aired not in the science ghetto of, you know, the Science Channel.
Mm-hmm.
It aired in prime time on network, and
yes,
that network was Fox.
Yep.
At the time, many people didn't know. They would learn this later. Fox already had interest in National Geographic and were the majority owners of National Geographic Channel. So that when Cosmos aired on Fox, it then immediately went around the world on that highly fertile National Geographic network that gets into multiple countries. So we were in 181 countries in 47 languages.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That was Cosmos. And it just Cosmos. Now hold me and anything I've been associated with aside. Let's look at other measures. Look at how many people attend Comic-Con. That used to be a fringy thing, maybe a few thousand people show up. Now hundreds of thousands of people show up, not only in the flagship Comic-Con in San Diego, but New York has a Comic-Con that's rivaling that in size and in participation. And everyone who attends, they're geeky and a little weird on occasion, but everyone there is scientifically literate. And
they that's right.
Meaningful scientific arguments about whether a lightsaber works or whether it's a culture that has risen and has finally taken its place at the table among people whose society has to reckons and respects. All of us in our day, you know, would get wedgies by the football quarterback, you know, in high school. So, but now we live in a time where the richest person in the world is the patron saint of geeks. And also, the Big Bang Theory TV show. If you type Big Bang into Google, the first thing that comes up is the TV show.
That's right.
Then the origin of the universe. So, so that is as one of the most successful shows in modern times. And you don't get that just by attracting geeks.
That's right.
The general public sees that, and it's real banter. It's real scientific banter. They have a PhD physicist as their on-set advisor all the time. And they have constantly recurring cameos of actual scientists. I had one, but others have been invited back many more times than I have. I didn't need them to remind me that I'm not really a good actor.
You've been all over the place on films lately.
Thanks for noticing, but let me tell you why. I don't have any ambitions to be a movie star or TV star, but when an artist wants to put a little bit of science in their story, and I get a phone call,
you're the guy.
I'm there, because that is the measure that science has mainstreamed. When the artists start thinking, hey, I'm going to add some more science to this painting, to this script, to this set design. I have such deep respect for people when they want to go there. I got to give them all they need. And that's what I've done.
You brought up the Big Bang, and I've got to tell you, Neil.
I brought up the Big Bang TV show.
The TV show. I don't get the Big Bang universe. I just don't get it. I can't comprehend how something may have started from nothing. I can't comprehend how a minute particle may have blown up. I just don't get it. Help me a little bit.
Well, so let me lead off with a comment that will certainly not help you at all, but we have to start there, all right? Our senses arose from what was necessary for our survival, you know, on the Serengeti or wherever. Mm-hmm. Is it going to eat me or is it not? Am I running faster so that it won't catch me, or will I get caught? These are basic primal elements that our senses are pretty good at judging. The moment we start decoding the universe using methods and tools that go beyond our senses, the microscope to see the small, the telescope to see the large, the particle accelerator to see the high energy in the small, this is bringing the universe to us. It's quantum physics, discovered in the 1920s, the weirdnesses that go on in nuclei and molecules and atoms, that is a whole other exposure to how the universe works, that our senses are ill-equipped to not only measure, but even if we do measure them, to even comprehend. So the universe is under no obligation to make sense to us. I mean, I have to just start.
There's your disclaimer right there.
The disclaimer. It is under no obligation. So what we've learned is the evidence is what matters. The measurements are what matters, not common sense. Because common sense will lead you astray when it comes to things that are not common. So if you run the math on the universe, the universe is expanding. It's bigger. Yes, it will be bigger tomorrow than today. It is bigger today than it was yesterday. You run that clock back. You are forced into a description of the universe where we were the size of an atom, and fascinating phenomena occur when we're that size. And we have some sense of that because we create conditions of dense matter and high temperatures, which all of our ideas tell us thrived in the early universe. And when you do that, you find out how particles are made and how hydrogen was formed, that the proton emerges and quarks come together, and all we see this happen. We've made a quarks gluon soup. That would be a condition of the early universe that's not otherwise accessible to anybody. When you do that and have it expand, you get the universe that we see. That's what gives us confidence.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't just pull this out of some orifice in our body. We were forced into it by the observations of the early universe. And the only reason why we can tell you anything that happened in the early universe is because light takes time to reach us. And so when we look out, we see things not as they are, but as they once were.
As they were, that's right.
That's right. And fortunately, that goes far enough back to include phenomena that occurred at the Big Bang, shortly after the Big Bang. That's the famous cosmic microwave background. And without that, we would be clueless. We would think, oh, the universe just always was and always, we'd have no data. And we wouldn't even be talking about it.
It is still one of the most perplexing questions I think we can ever come up with.
Well, so far.
So far.
Yeah, so far.
I mean, it just shakes your head. So let me ask you this, and we'll go to calls. You're a scientist. You've been a scientist. I'm sure as a youth you were fascinated with science. That's what got you into where you are today.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe in God?
Well, so I did this exercise once. If you go online and just type in God, there are a couple of sites that come up, and one of them is fascinating. And it's a rolling scroll of all the gods that human civilization has worshipped ever since we've had records of this. So going back about 6,000 years. And it just goes on and on. And on. You know, there's Vishnu and Zeus and Poseidon and Yahweh and so you say, wow, okay. Now, when people say, do you believe in God? I should say, which of these gods are you talking about?
Right.
Right. But generally, we're in the West, and it's the United States, and Christianity is dominant, and monotheism is dominant. So generally, people are referring implicitly to the God of the familiar Bible. And so what I can tell you, if that's the God you're referring to, that generally people reference God as being all-knowing, some combination of all-knowing and all-powerful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, why else have a deity?
Mm-hmm.
It's at least that. And so so all-knowing, also all-good, right? Especially all-good. That's an important feature of a God that you're going to worship. And so if that's the case, what intrigues me is all the things about nature that no one would assess as being good. So, for example, you know, tsunami and in the Indian Ocean, that this is some years ago, kill us. Forget human violence against humans. That's not even what I'm talking about. I'm talking about nature, things we do not control, things that are out of our control. There was an earthquake in Lisbon, Portugal, back in the mid-1700s, that took place on All Saints Day in the morning hours where everyone was in church.
Oh, boy.
Worshiping.
With churches so, collapsing, I bet.
Exactly, because what are the biggest structures in any town of the day? It's a church. What is the most susceptible to an earthquake? It's the church. 80,000 people died that day, not only from the earthquake that took out the churches, the largest structures that happened to be churches, but the tsunami that followed. And so, so this forced philosophers of the day to ask the question, if there is a God, that God is either not all-powerful or not all good.
Well, the God of the Bible, to me, was...
So the original Bible, the Jewish Bible, yes, the Old Testament.
Was horrid, you know?
That one was like, oh my God, that God was...
Now, if you were to ask me if I believe in God, I would simply say... Go ahead, ask me, by the way.
Okay, do you believe in God?
I do, but I don't know what God is. I'm perplexed by it. There's so much order in this universe. It defies logic for me that all this was an accident or just happened. There just seems...
You can take this posture. You can say, this is a line in a song by Blood, Sweat, and Tears. It's the line, I know there ain't no heaven, but I pray there ain't no heaven.
Yeah, exactly.
But the universe is not only highly ordered in some fascinating ways, it's also highly disordered. And if you sweep that under the rug, you're left with the impression that the universe is this beautiful, ordered, stately place. But it's not. Like I said, we have asteroids rendering 70% of all species of life on Earth extinct. That happened 65 million years ago. Is that the ordered, beautiful universe you're referencing? We have animals that are parasitic that can... even those that affect humans, is a worm that embeds inside the eyeball newborn children and renders them blind. And that insect, I mean, that parasite is just doing its thing, right? It's trying to survive like anybody else. Look what it's doing to humans. And so if you're honest about how you assess things, whatever is your understanding of God will need to include the death, destruction, and mayhem that nature wreaks upon us and our civilization. And the Greek gods, their religion, had a way to accommodate that, right? Their gods were not all good. They were capricious, and they were they had whole storylines behind their birth and lives and their own sense of revenge. And when the storm came, that was Poseidon was angry, right? We got that. And so that was how they accounted for nature, for the disruptions that nature brings to us. But if your God is all good, it just makes it harder. So I remain unconvinced by what I see in nature, given people's account of what God needs to be to have that nature that we experience.
Let's take some calls here. I could talk to you for 10 more hours, but we better get to these calls. Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Bill, thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, Dr. Tyson. Yes, I'm an amateur astronomer and an atheist, which George Norrie failed to say, but that's okay. I wanted to say that first because I agree with everything you just said, but I have two questions that don't involve religion. The first question is on the James Webb Space Telescope in relation to Tabby Star, that may have the alien megastructure around it. And the second question relates to Donald Trump and NASA. I'll explain. Question number one, the James Webb Space Telescope, there's a great article, I think you know, in today's New York Times Science Times section. My question specifically, when James Webb is launched in less than 2 years, October 2018, since it's an infrared space telescope, heat energy, will it be aimed at and be able to tell if at Tabby Star, if by maybe picking up some anomalous heat, if there indeed may be, in fact, an alien megastructure that's making that star dip, I think it's 22% or something like that at odd times. And question number two regarding President-elect Donald Trump, who I can't stand, I voted for Hillary Clinton. But nevertheless, my question is relating President-elect Donald Trump to NASA. since he is talking about infrastructure on planet Earth, will he be not only for a space infrastructure? In other words, what I'm saying is, could Donald Trump be the 21st century John F. Kennedy with regards to space exploration?
Wow. Okay. So a couple of things. Let me take your second question first, and then back into the other one. I haven't seen any write-ups on his space policy.
No, nor have I, Neil.
And there's random other commentary that doesn't have enough precision to base analysis on. So I'd have to wait until I see what his actual plans are before I can react. And so, but you're right. If he's a real estate developer. He builds stuff. So it may be sensible to think that if he wants to rebuild our infrastructure, then we say, hey, we can build stuff in space too. That might sit comfortably with him.
Right, and he may push privatization of space even
that
more.
As well. And so that could be in his DNA in ways that we haven't yet seen. So I reserve judgment until I see something more detailed. Now, in regard to Tabby Star, just to get people up to speed on that, it's a star observed by the Kepler telescope. This is the telescope that I said earlier was designed to spot planets orbiting host stars that are Earth-like planets around sun-like stars. And one of the stars, and by the way, it does that by watching the light of the host star dip as the planet passes between us and that host star in its own orbit around it. So it's basically a little bit of an eclipse, but it's a tiny eclipse. It's like a 1% drop or less in the brightness of the star because the light is getting blocked. So you're seeing not so much the planet itself. You're seeing the sunlight dip in brightness because it's getting occulted by this moving object. All right. So we have some expectations based on our knowledge of the structure of solar systems, what these things should look like. And this is what led to the catalog with 3,000 planets in it. One such star, Tabby Star, named after the lead author of the paper that announced it, has light dimming that we cannot explain by any rational means. 22%. This would have to be some humongo planet never before imagined. And plus it's irregular. So there are features of this that we don't know. This immediately led highly imaginative people to suggest that there could be an alien civilization there building structures to surround their host star to capture its energy to then make it a more potent civilization, since the power of civilizations flows by how much energy they wield. So that's an interesting suggestion. It's just a little awkward to explain something we don't understand with something else we don't understand. That's just, I try to avoid that because it's fun and it makes good storytelling, but not always does it make good science. So, yes, if there are structures they're building around it, there should be an extra infrared signature because it's capturing the heat of the host star. And there's no reason in principle why the James Webb Space Telescope couldn't take a few extra looks at it. That's what we do generally in astrophysics. If there's a target of interest, we put all telescopes of all different wavelengths of light focused on it, so that we can get all kinds of data that we can to get a coherent understanding of the phenomenon.
Love science. We're coming back with final questions for Neil deGrasse Tyson on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment just ahead with Neil deGrasse Tyson, his latest book, Welcome to the Universe. And we'll get to your calls next hour. Medium James Von Prague joins me as we talk about the afterlife. Coast Insiders, thank you for everything. That's our Thanksgiving. Thank you for everything you've done for us. And those of you who are not Coast Insiders yet, you can be. It's a great way to become part of the program. You simply just go to coasttocoastam.com and sign up for it. It's 15 cents a day where you get downloads, podcasting. Lex is working on a few more goodies for you. So you can pick it up as a gift for somebody else as well by going to coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, Neil deGrasse Tyson with us. Neil, you all set for the holidays?
Yeah, I think so.
Great.
You know, it's people are now kind of making fun of how awkward Thanksgiving dinners can be, especially given the political divide that has,
oh my God, it's huge,
split families. So there'll be a lot of good stories to share on Friday after Thanksgiving Day.
I'd rather talk about the cosmos over dinner than politics, wouldn't you?
Yeah, any day of the week. Yeah.
To the phones we go. Joe in the Bronx. Welcome to the show, Joseph. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How are you?
Wonderful.
Great. Yeah, I'd like to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
And I have a question for Neil deGrasse Tyson. I have two, actually. One dealing with Mars. If we drill deep enough beneath Mars' surface, do you think we'll be able to find life or traces of life? And also, regarding asteroids, if we do deflect an asteroid or maybe explode an asteroid, how can we avoid the debris from that asteroid from hitting the Earth? And is there a way we could lasso an asteroid and pull it out towards space?
Yeah, all great questions. So with regard to Mars, we know from surface evidence that there was once running liquid water, which is completely bone dry, gone today. And all evidence says that it seeped down and became a kind of permafrost. If you're familiar with permafrost, it's not just pockets of water that are frozen. The water is mixed in the soils of the soil is not the right word for Mars, but it gets the point across. There's a regolith, which is either pulverized rock. Soil would generally we think of as having organisms in it that can promote life. But the material that is marked the Mars surface, if the water seeps down, then it's frozen in and among the material that is that surface. So most of the water that's on Mars is not in just some tappable reservoir. That doesn't preclude there having been some kind of aquifers that ended up freezing over. And so if that's the case, and if there's some energy sources that are down there that keep it liquid, yes, there's some high expectation, some hopeful expectation that we find some kind of microorganisms thriving there. Or frozen evidence of frozen evidence of there having once been thriving a biota there. So yes, there are a lot of hopeful people thinking. So future Mars missions will have to include the ability to drill, to dig. And the next best thing is looking at these cuts, these ravines, where you get free depth views simply because there's a cut in the terrain. And then you get, and what we've seen is seeping water coming out from the sides of that, seasonally dripping. So yes, we all have very high hope and expectations for it. With regard to an asteroid, that's why blowing up an asteroid is not really our first thing we want.
Not smart.
Yeah, that's, and we're really good at blowing stuff up as a country and less good at knowing where the piece is when we're done. So deflecting an asteroid, though it will still be there to harm you again, deflecting an asteroid is by far the most sort of sensible plan about how to do this. And deflecting an asteroid is tantamount to putting it in some other orbit that you'll delay when it might want to come back again. But if you're good at this, it's not a problem. You just bat them away every time one comes near.
Well, I keep thinking of what you said about the size of a house, which is not that big.
Not even that big. So the energy to deflect it will be the little bit necessary so it doesn't hit Earth. Particularly if you deflect it early enough, then that little bit of side deflection accumulates over the years. If you get, you know, it's not coming straight at us and then we deflect it. You predict it 100 orbits in advance, and then you say, let's deflect it this little amount, and then it'll miss us completely. That's really how you would do this. It requires much less energy than hauling it out to some higher orbit. And the little ones are sizes of houses, bigger ones are the sizes of buildings. And no, it's just that would not be the best use of the energy available to us.
Our first-time caller, David, is in Kentucky. David, you're on with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Go ahead.
Hi, George. And
hi, David.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I was just wondering, on our first manned mission to Mars, that if something catastrophic does happen on the trip there or trying to land on Mars, do you think that will put our space travel behind to go back to Mars? Are there plans 28 months later when the windows open again to go immediately? And if something does happen, do you think that will shut down the program or slow down the program? Because I know how important getting to Mars is for the humankind to advance and to make sure that we don't go extinct like the dinosaurs.
All right. God forbid, Neil, what would happen?
Yeah, so we actually have good data on this possibility. So the your first thought out of the box, just as the caller perceptively asked, is if there's a disaster, will that be a death knell to the future of exploration? It turns out that when people die on the frontier of doing what no one has done before, it redoubles people's effort to want to accomplish that. The year, I've read this, the year that more people died than ever before climbing Mount Everest, the year after that had an upspike in the applications to climb the mountain. When a Challenger blew up, to a person, as you go down the line, to the loved ones, the wives and husbands and children, it was, this adventure must continue.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, disaster is, yes, it's tragic, but it does not have the effect you would think it has. We say to ourselves, we want to make sure they did not die in vain.
Well, look, the tragedies that we've had, Columbia, too. I think we had a little delay after that, but we kept going. But that was close to the end of the shuttle, wasn't it?
Exactly. That's why I think the Challenger is a better example of this.
Yeah.
And any kind of disaster, there's things that we might imagine and things we don't imagine, all right? The unknown unknowns, as they've been called. So yes, these are. I'm never going to be the first out to do something like that. I don't have that kind of bravery, but I'm fortunate that we are part of a species that includes people who would do such a thing first and take that risk. And so that's what got us out of the caves in the first place.
Neil, if you were asked to go to Mars, one-way trip, you can't come back, would you go?
If I brought the family and got a good Netflix account, maybe.
I wouldn't go. As much as I love space and the journey would be great, I think I would miss my friends and family.
Well, yeah, and plus there's a time delay. Well, I want to bring the family. I wouldn't go alone. No, that's not. No, you bring your friends and family.
What if they don't want to go?
Oh, yeah. Well, then maybe they're wiser than you.
Yeah.
That's real quick.
But there are some people who would take this one-way mission. They'd go.
Yes. In fact, the program Mars One, you can Google that, Mars One, O-N-E, is a program started by Baz Lansdorp, who's a Dutch entrepreneur, who wants to get people to go to Mars on a one-way trip because it's way cheaper than on a two-way trip. When he opened this up for interest, thousands of people signed up, and I had one of them on my Star Talk radio show. It's a guy, and I asked him, so what does your wife say about this? She said, oh, she was highly encouraging of it. Have you thought that through?
Jerry Purnell, the science fiction writer, but who's also into science and space, told me years ago, Neil, that before our manned mission to the moon, we were prepared to send just to be the first one, we were prepared to send an astronaut volunteer to the moon on a one-way mission. And we were going to continue to supply him with, food and goods and stuff until, he succumbed. But they actually had a couple volunteers ready to go, he said.
Was that just so they can be first out of the box?
Yeah, first out of the box.
Interesting, yeah. Well, except Kennedy said return him, put him out on the moon and return him safely to Earth, so that kind of set another kind of priority there. You can't say, okay, no, we're going to renege on that and just send somebody to the moon and kill them there.
Well, of course, once they got rid of Kennedy, they changed the game plan.
Right. But yeah, it just executed the way it is. So, no, first I've learned of that. That's interesting. I do know that Nixon had a speech prepared for if we knew we could not bring back Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin.
Wow.
If something had gone wrong. It was an already written speech, and I've read it. It was quite beautiful and poignant that they would. And by the way, it was to be read while they were still alive, knowing that we would not bring them back, and therefore they would die on
God, would that have been emotional?
Right.
Oscar in Los Angeles. Hello, Oscar. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, my question is basically this. pardon me. What do you think is the progress of Apophis, and when will we know when it will hit the Earth?
Well, we don't know if it's going to hit the Earth, but we're talking about the asteroid, Neil.
Yeah, the asteroid Apophis. It's an asteroid discovered about 10 years ago or so.
Yeah.
That it was found to have an orbit that would intersect Earth's orbit. So it would be an Earth crosser. And generally, the Earth crossing asteroids we discover, we name after evil, malicious gods. So Apophis is an Egyptian god of death and destruction. It was later shown that Apophis would come close enough to Earth to really keep a close eye on it and on the level that it might actually hit us. But we needed better data to know for sure. And what better data does is it reduces the uncertainty cone of its trajectory through the solar system so that you can make a much more precise statement about whether it'll hit us and whether it won't. I was a big town crier about Apophis, just to get people sensitized to this risk. Better data ultimately came in to show that it will not hit us in its next two apparitions. So it'll be a close approach, and we'll get to see if the telescopes and possibly learn even more about Earth-crossing asteroids. So you can rest peacefully at night.
Scott in San Luis Obispo in California as well. Scotty, go ahead.
Hello, George. Hello, Dr. Tyson. Hey, I had a simple question to ask. You did the Cosmos series about 2 years ago, and they're very well done. I almost waited, everybody waited almost 35 years to have the next series. Do you know if there will be in the works in the years to come, possibly you'll be doing some more?
Thanks for asking that. To do it and to do it right and to do it well, we want to sort of get the band back together. Because it's a full creative effort. There's music. There's the animations. There's the set design. The writing. And so there are conversations, but Fox has not greenlit anything yet, so there's nothing to announce. But and just for what it's worth, the Cosmos we did was 35 years after the first one. It was funny to have finished it and then have people come up to me and say, when are you going to do another one? I said, maybe that's the wrong time to ask. Like a woman just giving birth and say, going to have another kid? Let that settle in for a bit before you try to get the second one. It was a huge effort of us all. It's like making a 14-hour movie. And it's a, I don't mind a little bit of time between consecutive Cosmoses. But again, we're waiting for a green light before any kind of announcement gets made.
How did that evolution occur for you, Neil, when you started doing the show?
Yeah, so I'd been friendly with the Sagan family for several years, and I met Andrean, Sagan's widow, and co-author of both of the original and the most recent Cosmos. We met on the board of the Planetary Society, an organization that Carl Sagan co-founded in 1980 to get people sensitive to space and its value and the cosmic perspective. And in that meeting, it was a kind of a natural conversation about thinking about a next Cosmos. And I said, I think I could serve that role if you're, because she owns the franchise.
Okay.
Andrean. And I said, I'd be happy to serve that role, but I know, do what you think is best. And then the conversation came back to me. And given that I've met Carl and his influence on me, influenced so many, also influenced me, I thought I had a fun story I could share. And mid the rest of the storytelling that we pursued. And that's how that came to pass.
Well, you're very comfortable. You're very natural. You obviously know your material. And, you're just the perfect fit for it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I think that is a high compliment to fill the shoes of someone who had unfillable shoes, basically.
Hmm. Yeah. I loved his book, Contact, and his and the movie. The movie was still one of my favorites.
It's still one of my favorites as well. Yeah.
George and Jackson.
Well, 20 years. It's still lives.
It's fantastic. Let me ask you this, Neil, before we take final calls, because the clock's ticking. Do you believe that extraterrestrial life, UFOs, that they visited us, that they have been here to this planet?
So, a couple of things. Now every person in the world, essentially, is a walking photographer.
That's right.
Equipped with a video camera.
That's right.
So, one might have expected that if aliens were visiting at the rate that we had all imagined from eyewitness reports, that we'd have good video footage of that by now. Because we have video footage of other extremely rare things that you kind of knew were happening. We have video footage of buses tumbling in the winds of a tornado. There was a day when you wouldn't say, hold that thought, let me go get a camera and then photograph it. No, you're running for your life. Now, everybody's got a video camera. We do photograph rare things, and in that list are not, anybody shaking hands with aliens. So I'm disappointed because I want to meet the aliens, right? So there's not good evidence to convince a skeptic that we've been visited by intelligent aliens from another planet. Plenty of mysterious stuff in the sky, I'm not denying that, but just because you see something in the sky that you don't know what it is, does not mean that we're being visited by intelligent aliens. That one doesn't follow from the other. And So I'm waiting for just way better evidence than anything that's come forth thus far. And it won't take much, right? A landing in Times Square or the White House lawn or, I worry that if it lands during Comic-Con, that no one will notice because everyone else
I love it. Hey, I went to an event that you should go to. I went to it in Santa Clara this year. It's called Alien Con. Put on by the group who puts together the Ancient Aliens program on the History Channel.
On the History Channel.
They had 10,000 people there, Neil, this
year. Wow.
Which is...
Nobody doesn't love the aliens. I mean, I think we want to know that we're not alone. And
right.
The urge is very natural, and I've got it too. I'm just waiting for better evidence. Yeah.
Let's see if we could squeeze George in, Jacksonville, Florida. Only have about a minute, George. Go ahead.
Thanks. A couple of... one question.
One quick
applies
one.
Both to the Earth and to Mars. On Lagrange points, or neutral gravity points, I saw a diagram one time of between the Earth and Sun, and then on each side of our path and on the other side. Can we put sand in space to cool off the Earth if we need to, and how much would we need to, how many tons would we need
God.
To drop the temperature 1 degree? And on Mars... it needs more weight to hold an atmosphere, and it also needs to be warmer if we're going to sustain life easily. And can we do the same thing there on each side of Mars and put more light on Mars?
God, this planet's so big, Neil. Could we do that?
Well, so what you're talking about is more broadly. You're talking about geoengineering. You're talking about having the power to change large-scale systems on Earth. In this particular case, the climate. There are these Lagrangian points. There's five of them. And the L5 Society was referencing the fifth of those, which is one of several that are stable. There are other gravitational balance points that are unstable, like a marble balanced on a hill that would fall left or right, where you can put balance a marble at the bottom of the hill, and you can displace it, but it'll return to the bottom. So that you can have unstable equilibrium and stable equilibrium. And these Lagrangian points are equilibrium points. I think three of them are stable, two are unstable, or two and three. But in any case, if you can build structures in space to either deflect sunlight or rebeam sunlight, then these are geoengineering
points. Ah, that's not a bad idea. Neil, we're out of time. The book, Welcome to the Universe, Neil deGrasse Tyson. He was last with me 3 years ago. We got him back now. We'll bring him in a little sooner next time.